How did the recent terrorist attacks in Manchester and London impact on the UK elections? What do the results mean for the future of democracy and security in Britain? Are there any anomalous details surrounding the attacks that should cause us to question the true intentions of the perpetrators? How are the accused terrorists in high-profile incidents spanning the UK, France, and Brussels linked with state intelligence agencies? How have the Islamist extremist terrorist networks put together since the Carter administration evolved over the decades? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we inspect the recently completed election campaign in the United Kingdom with a special emphasis on the terrorist attacks hitting Manchester 2 weeks ago and the London Bridge and Borough Market the weekend before the election. Our guests include political economists Radhika Desai and UK national Alan Freeman, Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Newswire, and former diplomat, whistleblower, and book author J. Michael Springman. On this week's program, UK elections in a cauldron of terror, dissecting the outcome. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 9th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Since late 1947, and even before and up to the present, Palestinians have had and are still having many liberty incidents, without benefit of a Sixth Fleet, recalled or not. It is clearly Israel's intention to continue until there are no Palestinians left in Palestine. Liberty assaults are continuing in the U.S. and other powerful countries, as well as Israel and its Zionist interests in these countries wield sufficient power on their governments to bend military and political power to their ends. Thus, it is no accident that U.S. and Western might has been used to destroy Israel's potential enemies and rivals in the region, such as Iraq, Libya, and Syria, and to bring to heel others such as Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the Gulf monarchies. The people of half the world are paying the price for Israel's ambitions, not least in countries like the U.S., whose military budgets swallow funds for infrastructure, health, and education, and create an ongoing supply of shattered veterans who are neglected by the very government they served. That comes from the article, Israel's Liberty Attack Did Not Begin or End in 1967, by Free Palestine Movement, posted June 8th. It was in truth the worst attack ever carried out on a U.S. naval vessel in peacetime. In addition to the death toll, 171 more of the crew were wounded in the two-hour assault, which was clearly intended to destroy the intelligence-gathering vessel operating in international waters, collecting information on the ongoing fighting between Israel and its Arab neighbors. The Israelis, whose planes had their Star of David markings covered up so Egypt could be blamed, attacked the ship repeatedly from the air and with gunboats from the sea. When one Israeli pilot hesitated, refusing to attack what was clearly an American ship, he was instructed to proceed anyway. The most disgusting part of the tale relates to how U.S. warplanes sent to the Liberty's aid from an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean were called back by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, acting under orders from President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who declared that he would rather see the ship go to the bottom of the sea than embarrass his good friend Israel. That comes from the article, Remembering the USS Liberty, the 50-year cover-up of a mass murder of U.S. servicemen orchestrated by Israel and its friends, by Philip Giraldi, posted June 6th, originally appearing at the UNZ Review. As Penick observes, the single biggest factor that galvanized Arab Americans was the dispossession of Palestinian Arabs occasioned by the creation of the State of Israel and its occupation of Palestinian territories. In order to establish Israel as a Jewish state in 1948, nearly 700,000 Palestinian Arabs were expelled from their homes and their land. They call it the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic. A second catalyzing event occurred in June 1967, 50 years ago this month. Israel, with help from the United States, invaded Egypt, Jordan, and Syria, and seized the Palestinian territories in the West Bank, Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. That comes from a book review of The Rise of the Arab American Left, Activists, Allies, and Their Fight Against Imperialism and Racism, 1960s to 1980s, by Pamela E. Penick. Under the headline, The Arab American Left and Palestine, The Untold Story, by Marjorie Cohn, posted June 6th, originally appearing at Truthdig. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The UK elections, in some sense, were unprecedented in that they took place on the heels of not just one, but two major violent attacks taking place just in the last 3 weeks of the campaign. To talk to us more about those attacks, some of the suspicious aspects of them, and how they may have impacted the election, we're joined from Plymouth, UK, by Patrick Henningsen. He is a writer, political analyst, the founder and executive editor of 21st Century Wire. He also functions as a news analyst for RT and for UK Column. And he has a regular Sunday program called Sunday Wire. I hope I got all that right, Patrick. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Michael.
Okay, so Patrick, I think like most people who have been watching from abroad, I had the impression that these attacks were a major aspect of this election. I mean, I guess probably is just about the only thing we would have heard about other than the election itself. So I'm just kind of wondering, not only because there's this issue of the attacks happening, but we heard some rather draconian measures being dragged up. I mean, just in the last few days, we heard Theresa May talking about the human rights, in a sense, being disposable in the name of security. I mean, it's a paraphrase, of course. And the revelation that I believe for the first time you saw military, working alongside the police to control the situation after these attacks. So I'm wondering if you'd care to elaborate a little bit on what you think the impacts that these attacks may have had one way or the other on how people voted.
Yeah, and so there were actually, if you count the Westminster attacks, which I think took place in April, a month before the two big ones in Manchester and London Bridge, then there's kind of, you're looking at really three attacks. And, the general election was called just after, right around the same time as the Westminster attacks. So it was kind of this triptych progression. How they affected the election is they were more of a backdrop. If you were to be more conspiratorial, you might think that maybe someone intended to affect the election with these last two supposed terrorist attacks, supposedly ISIS-inspired terrorist attacks in the UK. And how would they affect the election? There's some people would look at that and say that, well, this Prime Minister Theresa May and this Conservative government has put a lot of currency in this idea of strength under their leadership, strong leadership and unity and so forth. And so this is a strong government that will protect its people. Whereas the media was maligning the Labour candidate Jeremy Corbyn as being a terrorist sympathizer. The tabloids absolutely went after him. I think every single major British newspaper was demeaning and running ad hominem personal attacks against Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, except for maybe the Daily Mirror or the Mirror newspaper. And so pretty much everybody else was after him. So all these talking points were spun up to basically put Jeremy Corbyn and Labour into sort of this pro-terrorist, believe it or not, this is how it was spun in the British press, pro-terrorist camp or category, whereas Theresa May and the Conservative government would be sort of, you know, anti-terror and, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the international community, NATO, etc. Now let's look at the result. Okay, it didn't come out quite like that. So you could say that the voters weren't pushed in that direction. The Conservative Party did not get the sort of outright majority that they were hoping they would get, that the pollsters said they might get a month ago. So you could say that this backfired somewhat on the Conservative government and Theresa May. But let's look at the nuts and bolts of what changes actually happened as a result of the Manchester bombing and London Bridge. So you have to look at the statements made by the Prime Minister. So what always happens in the wake of any of these high profile terrorist events is that the state will move in to increase its power. It will pull back privacy and pull back rights, which were in the hands of the people in America and constitutionally. You can look at the Patriot Acts 1 and 2 and the National Defense Authorization Act. And in Britain, there's been a whole string of these since the 7/7 attacks in 2005. And so the Theresa May's speech that, you know, we need to basically combat online extremism. So straight away, going to formalize some sort of government measure to give the government or the government some sweeping powers or pressure their corporate partners, as they sort of refer to them unofficially, like the Googles, the Facebooks, and Twitters of the world, to somehow clamp down on extremist rhetoric online. And you can read into that.
It seems to me that there's been some conflation between the terms terrorism and extremism. Extremism does not necessarily mean violence. And so when they're talking about cracking down on extremism, I mean, that's part of the draconian measures that are being dragged up that can impact, you know, all kinds of people that may not pose any kind of a real threat to the population.
Yes, that's a very good point. And it comes in, the new measures, the new control measures by the state will come in, or the corporate control measures in this case as well, will come in by the state under the letter of fighting terrorism. But once those controls are in place, once the policy is enacted, then it's just a question of massaging the language. So from terrorism to extremism, which could mean absolutely anything. And in fact, you can even downgrade extremism to disturbing speech or disturbing behavior or disturbing rhetoric. And this can go, you can keep going to offensive speech or offensive rhetoric. And this can go either left or right. The interesting thing of how this is framed, the really big unreported story in the wake of Manchester and London Bridge, is that this has invigorated a sort of movement on both the right and both the left wings of the political spectrum. Rampant jingoism, Islamophobia, completely out of control. Totally out of control. The waterfall on Twitter on the night of the London Bridge attacks, on the hashtag London Bridge, and you can read some of the things that were being said. Unbelievable. And, you know, people wonder how, you know, this might seem like an extreme statement to some people, but I don't think so. People say, well, how could the Germans have gotten to the point under Nazi Germany that the people would have, allowed such things to happen in terms of, you know, mass deportations and so forth. And likewise in America with Japanese internment camps. Well, the answer is staring us in the face. Just look at social media feeds and look at the rhetoric that's being pushed out. All the while, the state, the intelligence agencies, there's no real audit of what they're doing and what's their role in cultivating some of these situations and some of these individuals who most every single one of them appear to have some ties to terrorist groups or militant extremist groups operating in places like Libya and Syria,
yeah,
for instance.
Let's focus on that aspect of it then, the known wolves, the idea. I mean, and you and your associate, Sean Helton, have documented this, like virtually every major attack, including the ones that have happened recently in the United Kingdom, they were known by these by British intelligence. In fact, even says that the method of the attack, the vans and knives, was already been broached. I think that for example, I think there's Khurram Butt, known by MI5, and there was another one that came out just yesterday. So you could talk maybe a little bit, if you could comment on the significance of those revelations of these known wolves, not lone wolves, but known wolves who are, and that they're so well known to British intelligence.
Sure. So this is a pattern that we can see not just from Westminster. So Westminster with Khalid Massoud, this was the known wolf, absolutely known to authorities, was actually a suspect in an investigation into a terrorist attack on the city of Luton, which is about an hour northeast of London. And this was back in 2009, 2010. So he already had a file. And MI5, British internal intelligence, was also involved in that investigation, or, I'm going to say possibly in that operation, and because the pattern just continues. And then we go on to Manchester and Salman Abidi, and so whose father was a member of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. This is a group that has been working with British intelligence and arguably with the CIA since, I would say, the mid-90s at least, okay? And the son, who was the alleged bomber in Manchester, is also accused of being involved with this militant group on some level as well. So there's that connection. And so all of these fighters from Libya were known wolves in the sense that, hundreds of them. And there was a group in Manchester called the Manchester Boys. They even had this call sign while they were fighting down in Libya, and all under the supervision of Abdul Hakim Belhaj, which is a known CIA asset, formerly interned in Guantanamo Bay, released at just the right time to begin the buildup of what we saw, in my opinion anyway, in Libya in 2010, who went on to become governor of Tripoli after the fall of Gaddafi. And so we see him connected to the Abidi family, but also to Rashid Wadhwan from London Bridge. And so this was a militant group, Lilwa al-Umma, which went from Libya and moved on to Syria afterwards, and was affiliated with al-Nusra Front and the Free Syrian Army, and was active in places like Aleppo right after the fall of Gaddafi. And so here we go. This is one of the London bombers, and it's admitted, it's proven of al-Nusra and these groups' links to the militaries of NATO member states, in not only in the train and equip program, but intelligence assistance for the so-called rebels, or they're referred to as moderate rebels early on, and they dropped that term. Now they're widely regarded as at least either rebels or terrorists. But and again, you see Belhaj, I don't know what to call him, a double agent. So involved in the transfer of 600 of these Libyan fighters into Syria in 2011-12. And then you have Youssef Zagba, who was caught and detained by EU officials. And before he was traveling via Bologna, Italy, from that flight to Turkey, they knew he was going to fight for ISIS. And for some reason, they couldn't detain him. I don't know why. That's an interesting story that maybe mainstream journalists who have some resources and some clout can go and dig into that story if they really wanted to. Why was he allowed to move on? We don't know. And one of these was also carrying an Irish ID, which was conveniently left at the scene, I think, of the London Bridge attack. So all these are known wolves. And we see the same in Orlando, in America. We also have the same with even the Boston bombers. Tamerlan, the older brother Tamerlan Tazarinov, was being actively recruited by the FBI. No doubt they have a file on him or had a file on him. All of these, we see this pattern emerging. This is a disturbing pattern because this means this is a consistent identifier through each and every one of these events. So it would make sense. Occam's razor would suggest that, you know, maybe this is a good area to start inquiring in exactly how involved are the intelligence services or police intelligence or whoever in possibly running these cells. I can give you a list of informants and patsies and dupes from U.S. and Canadian terror attacks right now, and it's quite a long list. And also I'll add the Europeans in there. I think we have about 30 open cases that we've reported on 21st Century Wire of the 30, 40 different people. So this is beyond a coincidence. And at some point, people have to sort of wake up and say, well, who is driving the so-called domestic terror problem in North America and in Western Europe? Is it really organic and homegrown, or is it actually being driven by the activities of the security services of intelligence agencies who knows why, for whatever political agenda? If you look back in history, there's actually a precedent for this. It's called Operation Gladio, and you can read about this. This has been researched in detail by Daniel Ganser, and many other people have written excellent books on it. It's very well referenced. And so this is when there was a cell in NATO intelligence, which was being run by the CIA, which was completely autonomous and was using elements of organized crime gangs to carry out random terror attacks throughout Europe, and it killed many people.
You bring up some interesting points there, Patrick. And of course, so many angles. I mean, these people are being flagged, and still they're able to commit these acts. And, you know, somehow you have like more, we need more surveillance, and we need to be able to, have these, draconian measures. And yet, it doesn't seem to be enough because let's face it, we already have anti-terrorism measures that are, questionable. But it causes me to ask the question, and we might even just leave it at that, but what you're putting forward, as you mentioned, is it's not being brought up by mainstream media or even any of the politicians, any of the opposition politicians. I don't hear Jeremy Corbyn even talking about it. He's talking more police powers or more resources for police. So what does that say to you about if this is the focus we need to have on, not so much the election result, because there's this, I think you mentioned, deep state apparatus that's staying in place regardless of the election outcome. So your comments.
Yeah, I think that it's a consolation maybe that Jeremy Corbyn brought in the issue of blowback. So basically attaching the event in Manchester and possibly to London Bridge as well, attaching that to British foreign policy or U.S.-British joint, coalition foreign policy in the Middle East or Libya, and how that is basically creating what's called blowback. Yeah, it's come back to bite us back at home. And so that's kind of a consolation prize in terms of a discussion point. It's not really the discussion I think we need to have. I think we need to go a little deeper than that. I think there's, definitely our intelligence agencies are essentially playing with fire to cultivate and recruit and sort of develop fighting cells that have been deployed in places like Libya and Syria, and then they're trying to manage them after these conflicts, and they're coming home, they're giving them housing benefit, they're putting them on welfare. In some cases, they're giving them political clout in terms of calling them the Syrian opposition or something like this, or, the Libyan exiled government and so forth. So you have a lot of these KLA from Kosovo as well, basically terrorists in every instance, from Kosovo to Libya to Syria. From the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, many of these people given political clout, given status. Look at Abdul Hakim Belhaj in Libya. He was you know, he's meeting and given this legitimacy, like he's some sort of a political figure. And he was interned in Guantanamo, and I don't know, possibly turned on in the Penny Lane program down there, and then redeployed back out into the field. There's a couple of the other characters as well that appear in Syria from Chechenian terrorists, and also from Kosovo, leading ISIS cells and platoons and so forth. So the blowback conversation is great, because at least I think it allows people to examine and puts a little pressure on the political body to sort of clean up its act, but it's not quite deep enough. And so the danger here is that if you look at the situation in British politics right now, you have a prime minister without a majority, you have a hung parliament, okay, so she could stitch together some sort of coalition and rule as effectively a minority government, right? But she could come down and call for a unity government. So we have to ask ourselves if we're not really questioning these terror events and what's actually caused them and who is actually involved, then the government, let's say another terrorist event happens. Let's say another one happens at the same time as, like, there's like three of them, one in France, one in Germany, one in the UK, and then Theresa May, the prime minister, Boris Johnson, wartime prime minister, might come and say, we need a government of unity now. We're being threatened existentially. And so we're going to come together and increase security powers. No more freedom of bringing electronic devices on flights. And we're also going to increase military operations in Syria or Yemen or whatever, wherever these terrorists are going to be coming from. Once they do their investigation in 24 hours after any of these events, they seem to know everything about all these people, and they are already firing up the jets for airstrikes, as France did in the wake of the attacks in Paris. Okay, so that sort of scenario is where we're headed, where we will have a one-party state, possibly under the letter of national security, and nobody will be able to argue with it or debate about it, because nobody is actually addressing some of the really core important aspects of, you know, how are these events actually coming about? Look at them, dissect them, deconstruct them, look at the history, look at the common threads. We see so many of them from some of the same characters featuring in some of these same dramas as well. In the background, some of these radical clerics from these extremist mosques funded by Saudi Arabian or Qatari money as well. They're given a free pass. Some of them have been accused of being informants for the intelligence agencies, like Abu Hamza from the Finsbury Park Mosque in the UK, and then, or Amjad Chowdhury, but they're just being swept away just gradually at the right time, and no one asks too many questions, and no one wants to know really how this little matrix is being constructed. And so this is the problem. This is a big danger if we don't really analyze this and maybe hold the deep state to account. We are really in a position where we could be, as a democracy, or governments in America or Canada or the UK or Western Europe, could be really held hostage by some of these terror events, when in fact there may be some rogue elements involved in these terrorist events that are very much connected with the government departments or agencies.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Patrick, but I really appreciate your sharing these rather unique insights. I don't think we hear these sorts of conversations in very many places these days. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been joined by Patrick Henningsen. He's a writer, political analyst. He is the executive editor and founder of 21st Century Newswire, and he is also a freelance news analyst for RT and UK Column. He hosts the Sunday Wire program, and you can catch more of his commentary and his analysis on the website 21stcenturywire.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We're joined on the line by J. Michael Springman. He is a former U.S. diplomat in the State Department's Foreign Service, holds degrees from American University, Georgetown University, and the Catholic University of America. From 1987 to 1989, he was chief of the non-immigrant visa section in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and it was at that time that he found himself overruled by his superiors when he would deny visas to travelers to the United States whom he had deemed unqualified. He's the author of the 2014 book Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View, in which he describes the American Visas for Terrorists program and the Arab-Afghan Legion. So, Mr. Springman, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I'm pleased to be able to talk to your listeners.
We recently aired on the show a program detailing the legacy of the recently deceased Zbigniew Brzezinski, in which we noted his role in constructing and organizing these Islamist terror brigades as a weapon to bring down the Soviet military presence in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It seems as if you had an unwitting role in that enterprise. I was wondering if you could share your insights into exactly how these extremists like Osama bin Laden and others managed to get trained and organized to do America's dirty work, first in Afghanistan and then in other problematic areas to the U.S. empire.
Sure. Well, when I was in Jeddah, I was kind of in at the beginning of America's creation of and support for global Islamic terrorism. I had been in Jeddah in the American Consulate General there, and of some 20 Americans, there were only three people, including myself, whom I knew for a certainty to have no ties of any kind with any of the American intelligence services, principally the CIA and the NSA, the National Security Agency, the people who essentially listen to your telephone conversations and read your emails. And before I left Washington, I had a strange 45-minute conversation with the then-American ambassador, Walter Cutler. And this guy talked to me about all the problems my predecessor, Greta Holtz, had created for the embassy in Riyadh. She was denying visas to the servants of rich Saudi women who couldn't travel to the U.S. unless they had their entourage of seamstresses, hairdressers, and other factotums. And I had expected it to be a five-minute hello and goodbye session and didn't quite figure what the message was he was trying to tell me. He was obviously trying to give me some kind of statement, but I really couldn't figure it out. Probably didn't grasp the fact that it was get with the program or else. But when I asked the desk officer there, the fellow who followed affairs in Saudi Arabia for the State Department, I asked him about this. He said, well, Walter Cutler, he's just a queer duck. And when I got to Jeddah, I was welcomed with open arms. People told me what a terrible person Greta had been. And then after a while, it was, we'd really like a visa for this guy. I it's your final decision, but you really should take a look at this guy because he's very important to us. And the first few they sent me were fine. And then as time went by, the Immigration and Nationality Act and the State Department's regulations say that these guys have to show ties to their own country or place of application that are strong enough to pull them back from the United States after a visit for a particular purpose. And I had people, for example, who were going on a trade mission to a trade show in the United States in automotive parts and accessories, couldn't name the show and couldn't name the city in which it was going to be held. And this went on through most of my time there, and it wasn't until I was out of the Foreign Service, after I essentially had been fired without being given a good reason why, that I learned from the journalist Joe Trento that what they were doing was recruiting the Mujahideen. And then the penny dropped and the scales fell from my eyes and I saw exactly what had been going on and why they were so hostile to me. As I was researching my first book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, I found out there had been also 52 recruiting offices in the United States that were rounding up recruits for the Afghan war. And this went on into Yugoslavia and Iraq and Libya and Syria. And it was just absolutely amazing, and it was American policy, and I began to wonder about this. I mean, it was Brzezinski who had said, well, what's more important, destruction of the Soviet Empire or a few stirred-up Muslims? Well, we got a lot of stirred-up Muslims. We have countries full of them. We have continents full of them now at this point, and as far as I can see, this is an immense failure. Yet the American policy to destabilize, dehouse, deculturalize, and destroy South and Southwest Asia and North Africa is continuing. And as I say in my new book, it's just come out, Goodbye Europe? Hello Chaos? Merkel's Migrant Bomb. All these people from all these destroyed countries are now being herded into Europe and destabilizing Europe as well. You've got street battles, you've got rapes, you've got murders, you've got astonishing rates of crime. And it all comes out of this policy of creating this, as I call it, the Arab-Afghan Legion to destroy countries in that area, in Middle East, North Africa. So it's just incredible, and nobody really questions it.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to go back a little bit in terms of, like, you mentioned that 17 of the 20 staffers at the Jeddah office were CIA,
mm-hmm.
and you were one of only three who were outside the U.S. intelligence. I mean, that seems like an astonishingly large number. Does it make sense to think that this is more than a that being a visa office might be some sort of a front for this operation? Or,
well, in essentially, the State Department is a home for the Central Intelligence Agency. Depending on who you talk to, at least one third of the people who say they are Foreign Service officers aren't. I once talked to a former CIA chief of station who told me it was about a third. And then I talked later to Jay Hawley, a real Foreign Service officer, who said, yeah, it's about a third. But you go to some places, and it's more. There was a former American ambassador who commented that it could be 50% in some places. So it really does go up and down. And depending on where you are and what the country or the situation is like, you might have more or you might have less intelligence officers of one kind or another working there under diplomatic cover, in addition to the non-official cover officers, people who pose as businessmen in various places like Jim Everett did in Scandinavia.
What would be the point of having a non-intelligence operative in your position? I mean, why not? Because wouldn't that, everybody was CIA, wouldn't that undermine the possibility of someone kind of blowing the whistle, as you have done?
Well, yeah, as Joe Trento said, what they wanted was somebody who was not an intelligence officer in my position. Because you could have plausible deniability. If somehow this didn't work out, you could say, well, he just wasn't measuring up to being a Foreign Service officer and get rid of him. Whereas if you had a real intelligence officer, although they did have one in Jeddah, Andy Weber, who was there part-time, you do have a sort of a front of having real State Department people there at the visa window, for example.
So you were kind of like a Lee Harvey Oswald, a patsy kind of person.
Yeah, exactly. I think I mentioned that in my book.
No offense, but
yeah, no, exactly right. You're entirely correct.
Okay, so yeah, so you have this operation, and as you alluded to, this it continued beyond Afghanistan to mm-hmm. Yugoslavia and Libya and all those other countries you mentioned. Have you seen an evolution over the years, or in terms of what you've researched, have you has it taken on a new strength? Has it become more powerful? Has it taken on a life of its own? Are there any, when you look at that trajectory from your days in Jeddah to mm-hmm. today, has there anything qualitatively altered?
Well, they're getting stronger, they're getting bolder, and they're getting more sophisticated in their propaganda campaigns. For example, attacking the Soviets in Afghanistan, they recruited these crazies, the worst people they could find, as Cheryl Bernard, the wife of Zalmay Khalilzad, the former American ambassador to Afghanistan, Iraq, and the United Nations, said. They're getting better at manipulating people's minds. You could see it in Yugoslavia, where they created Slobodan Milosevic as the Serbian Satan. And then they moved into Iraq and destabilized the entire country, trying to split it apart by encouraging the Sunni and the Shi'i to fight one another. And basically what they would do is simply have someone blow up a mosque of the other persuasion and blame it on the other crowd. And at one point, the British special forces were involved. They disguised themselves as Muslims and as Arabs, and were going about ready to blow up a couple of buildings until they were caught by the Iraqi security forces. And the British government broke them out of the jail with tanks and commandos. So they're getting incredibly bold. They removed Muammar Gaddafi, the director of Libya. He was his country had the highest living index, as measured by the United Nations, in all of Africa. I mean, they had great purchasing power. Everyone shared in the wealth. There were fewer people below the poverty line in Libya than in the Netherlands. So he was a secular man, and they got rid of him. Saddam Hussein was a secular man, and they got rid of him. And now Bashar al-Assad, also a secular man in Syria, you know, he's presiding over an increasingly wrecked country. I mean, it's never going to come back, just like Libya and just like Iraq. So they're very good at doing this. They've got the American people believing this. They think that they're all out there doing God's work, saving the world from Islamic terrorists, when in fact they're creating them and they're using them. And it supports the military-industrial complex. You know, it's great money. It's good for Lockheed. It's good for who makes bombs. It's good for whoever makes electronics used in guided missiles and things like this. So it's going from bad to worse, essentially.
Now, as I'm sure you're aware, there were these terror attacks in Great Britain over the last couple of weeks,
mm-hmm.
and there have been revelations about how the perpetrators or the suspected perpetrators of the attacks were all known to British intelligence agencies, and the man accused in the suicide bombing of the Ariana Grande concert in
mm-hmm.
Manchester, Salman Abadi, has been linked to with an outlawed terrorist group known as the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, LIFG.
Oh, yeah.
His father, Ramadan Abadi, was part of the LIFG at the time it fought against Gaddafi
mm-hmm.
During the NATO's regime change there in 2011. There was a group of these LIFG fighters in Manchester, living in close proximity to the Manchester bombings
mm-hmm.
suspect, Salman. So I'm wondering if you could, pouring into your research, if you could give us you enlighten us as to where the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group fits in with your understanding of the Mujahideen and the Arab
mm-hmm.
Afghan League organization.
Sure. Well, the LIFG fought in Afghanistan and were trained to be terrorists by the Central Intelligence Agency, by Mossad, by the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, ISI. And they had been used by the British in North Africa to fight against Muammar Gaddafi. According to Peter Dale Scott, the former Canadian diplomat, author, and university professor, he said the British intelligence found that al-Qaeda and the LIFG were useful tools to try and overthrow Gaddafi. And it was Gaddafi who was at one point in 1998 had tried to get Interpol to issue an arrest warrant for Osama bin Laden. And the leader of LIFG, one of the people involved in this, was Anas al-Libi, who had been given asylum in Britain, and he had been trained by the triple agent Ali Mohammed, who had worked for the American government, including the Army and the Central Intelligence Agency. And in 1998, MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Services, used and paid an al-Qaeda group, LIFG, to put a bomb under Gaddafi's car, and they were also paying lots of money to al-Qaeda. And this came out of David Shaler, a former MI5, the Security Service officer, who was charged under the Official Secrets Act for letting this be known. So it's the British were very closely tied to Libya and to terrorists in Libya of one flavor or another, and somehow they all went back to Britain. And in the case of the Manchester bombing people, these people had been part of the opposition to Gaddafi. They were essentially terrorists, and they were part of the February 17th Martyrs Brigade, one of the key fighting units in that war. And these were all in the group who freely came and went in between Libya and Britain. And the same held true for a number of these other people in the other attacks where they drove a car into a crowd on the pavement in Westminster. And when they drove the car into the crowd on London Bridge and did all those stabbings in the Borough Market. So it's the British somehow are also awfully close to a lot of the bad boys.
Unlike the United States, for which an attack like 9/11 was virtually unprecedented, hasn't Great Britain been subjected to terrorist attacks before from the IRA? Like,
oh, yeah.
What's different about this?
Well, it's a you beat the drums for the evils of Islam and the drums for the evils of Arabs, and you have to have an enemy out there since the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, and they haven't gotten too much headway claiming that Vladimir Putin and Russia is interfering in people's elections. So there's no violence, no threat of violence from people who hold half the world's supply of atomic bombs. So in this case, you need an amorphous enemy. It's people not like us. The Irish Republican Army were Catholics. They were they spoke English. They lived right next door. And in the case of Arabs and Muslims, well, you know, they're in this strange part of the world that we don't know that much about. Nobody travels to Damascus. Nobody goes to Baghdad anymore. And most of our embassies in those areas are closed. So they're convenient devils. Even though you do have a Muslim, Pakistani Muslim, as Lord Mayor of London.
It's kind of funny in a macabre way, the terrorists next door versus the alien terrorist.
Yeah.
But, of course, it's not funny. But I wanted to also, like, you know, bring up the idea of the coincidences with the Manchester attacks happening around the same time as that announcement of a major arms deal with Saudi Arabia. There was also that OSCE-wide anti-terror conference, the anti-ISIS strikes by Washington, that, you know, coming, you know, just after the Astana peace agreement. So I'm wondering if beyond the election, if these terror attacks are playing a role in terms of furthering a U.S.-centered or NATO-centered international agenda.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, you've got NATO, which is formed in the late 40s, early 50s, as a defensive alliance against the Warsaw Pact, organized by the then-Soviet Union. And now, instead of a defensive alliance, it's an offensive alliance, attacking in North Africa, attacking in Syria. And you've got the Americans and the Saudis helping each other destroy Yemen, which 80% of the population there is in need of dire need of humanitarian assistance. So I think that you know, it's going from bad to worse. You've got Trump, who pledged that he was going to end the forever war, characterizing Hillary Clinton as somebody who voted for the war in Iraq, and he didn't. Yet now that he's in power, he's sending commandos into Yemen. He's had 2 days' worth of airstrikes in Yemen not too long ago. And then later on, he sent, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 Tomahawk missiles dropping on Syria, blowing the place up. So it's just they're looking any way they can to come up with a reason and an excuse and a cover for attacking the Muslim and the Arab worlds and essentially dehousing, destabilizing, deculturalizing, and destroying these countries.
Just about at the end of my time, is there anything else that you think our listeners should draw from the recent attacks and the alignments we're seeing present themselves on the world stage?
Well, I think that people ought to look very carefully and very analytically at what is said. I mean, there's a joke that's far too true in the United States that something isn't true until the government denies it. So you've got to look at what, not only what the government says, all the nice anodyne words about how we're helping keeping you safe, and ask questions like, well, why are you keeping us safe? Why did you bomb Libya? Why are you bombing Syria? Why was NATO giving information to Osama bin Laden and the Kosovo Liberation Army to destroy the country and break it up? You've got to look past the propaganda. You've got to start seeing these people not as demons, but as people living in a war zone and having their countries and their civilizations being wrecked. So it's a matter of saying, well, yeah, he's an Arab, he's a Muslim, he may not be a Muslim, he might be a Christian and an Arab. But still, they're not demons. They are people who belong to a religion essentially of peace. And to ignore the attempts of the Americans, especially to split the two branches of Islam, the Sunni and the Shia, into two different parts. In the past, 1,000 years ago, they were virulent enemies, and now today they're basically simple branches of the same religion. And I've met Arabs who were who had a Sunni mother and a Shia father. So it's not religion essentially. It's what the Americans are doing and what NATO is doing, and the members of NATO like Britain or Canada or France or Germany or Italy.
Michael Springman, thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Well, I'm most grateful to be able to talk, and I thank you for the opportunity.
J. Michael Springman is a former U.S. diplomat in the State Department's Foreign Service, and he is the author of the 2014 book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World, An Insider's View. Hung Parliament. This was clearly not the result the Prime Minister was looking for when she called the election in mid-April. Before we close the show, I wanted to include some reaction to the election outcome from two observers in my home city of Winnipeg, Canada. Radhika Desai is professor at the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba, and Alan Freeman is a cultural economist and research affiliate at the University of Manitoba and a UK national. Both co-direct the U of M's Geopolitical Economy Research Group.
I think that the biggest story for tonight is the fantastic performance of the Jeremy Corbyn campaign. I think it's not just a question of campaign smarts. I think it's the emergence of a solid left-wing constituency in the UK once again after the long night of Blairism. I think this is the most important development. Of course, equally important, Theresa May has also lost another gamble. She felt a majority of 17 was not big enough for her to run her party in the way that she wanted. So the fact of the matter is that, like her predecessor, she gambled the country's future for the party. She lost again. And so we are now at the stage where she may no longer be the leader of the Conservative Party. Even if Mrs. May continues as leader and forms a government, minority government or whatever, or supported by the DUP or whatever it is, the fact of the matter is that even if the DUP is not going to support the Conservative government without insisting on a softening of the meaning of Brexit. So that means that the whole meaning of Brexit has changed. The final thing is that the Scottish nationalist position has been undermined in a very interesting way, because they lost the referendum originally, back in 2014 it was. They had won in all those constituencies where there was a majority against austerity. And they realized that the way to win elections is to campaign against austerity. So in 2015, the SNP was the only party offering an alternative to conservative austerity. That's why they swept the election. This time around, Jeremy Corbyn and his fantastic manifesto had given a UK-wide alternative to austerity. That is why Labour has made a 10%, whopping 10% increase in the vote for his party. Jeremy Corbyn has campaigned from the left. He has campaigned with a clearly socialist agenda. He has been vilified in the national media by people who called him a lover of terrorists and somebody who could not be trusted with the economy. In every way, he has been vilified, and he has put in a performance, as I say, the like of which I don't think has been seen in the history of the Labour Party ever. And so this is the first time in nearly 40 years we are seeing the emergence of a clear alternative to austerity. It is winning despite great odds, and I think that Corbyn's victory cannot be easily overturned.
Labour has created entirely new heartlands on the basis of basically speaking directly to people. and then using social media and appealing very clearly and correctly to the young. Corbyn made two very important promises just in the last closing days of the election. He said, we will abolish tuition fees and we will repay all student debts. Now, this has lessons for Canada. This has lessons for the left all over Europe. You now have a situation in Europe where this is the largest majority for a largest vote for a clearly left-wing socialist platform. People are now talking about whether Corbyn will be the next prime minister, because Theresa May's head is not easy under her crown, and there's a 50-50 call being put on whether she will actually be prime minister tomorrow. I would bet money, if you want, that in a week's time we will not see Theresa May being the Prime Minister of Britain. And if she is, there's still a mess, because then they're going to have to send her, humbled by this vote, to negotiate with one of the most powerful countries in Europe, which is Germany and the German bankers. And it's not going to work for the British people. So I think that the lesson is that there's a fundamental shake-up of politics going on. It was predicted. You have all these guys on television saying, who could have predicted it? Who knew? It's so unexpected. It wasn't damn well unexpected. It was, these people did not understand what the F star 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 was going on, and they need to wake up.
The other thing is that you have to remember that we have seen many anti-establishment upsets. This is an anti-establishment upset with a clear radical direction. It's not like Trump's win. It's not like Brexit. It has a direction, and it is in it. There is a clear rational progressive agenda behind it. So it's not like a blind flailing against the establishment. It has real progressive meaning.
He stood up to the ferocious attack on the question of fighting racism. Labour has not, for once in its life, has not flinched on standing up to racism. He stood up on the question, which is usually and classically used to unseat a challenger, of terrorism. He's taken a very clear position, and he's opened a discussion in Britain, quite correctly, on the fact that we shouldn't be going to war with people if we want to really prevent the causes of terrorism. And it's not gone down badly. The evidence is the majority of people say, yeah, we should rethink whether we're doing wars of intervention. That's highly relevant to the Canadian political establishment. They have not learned that lesson. So this puts the Labour Party in a strong position to be a party of government. And that's an extraordinary development. The last thing I would say is keep an eye on the North of Ireland. The future of the North of Ireland does not lie in the United Kingdom of Great Britain. And sooner or later, both parties to the Good Friday Agreement, including the DUP, are going to have to come to grips with that. And that is going to come by way of reconciling themselves with the fact that a Britain outside Europe, outside the social protection that Europe provides, outside the remaining progressive institutions of Europe, is not doing any good to the people of Ireland, and maybe their future is with the people of the South. So keep your eyes on that prize as well.
One final point. I think that the advance that Corbyn represents is a very important one from the point of view of the politics of the West as a whole. This is the first time that such a radical left-wing party and program has made such a lot of headway in a major Western capitalist economy.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.